Over the course of his 40-odd-year career, Philip Glass has established himself as one of America's best-known, influential, and celebrated composers. He's even been nominated for 3 Academy Awards. Now, some of Mr. Glass's most famous compositions have been compiled into a 10-disc retrospective set called Glass Box. It's out from Nonesuch Records, and I'm very pleased that it brings Philip Glass back to the show today. Hi.
Hi, Glenn. I'm very pleased to be here.
This box set includes compositions from the operas, Einstein on the Beach, Satyagraha, the film Koyaanisqatsi, various symphonies, and lots more. 10 record set, but I have a feeling you had to leave a lot out.
You know, Leonard, I didn't make the selection. It would have been almost impossible for me to have done that. I'm sure there was a lot left out because I think at this point I probably made 50 records, and this is 10. Mm-hmm. Probably made more than that. But this was really the brainchild of Bob Hurwitz, who's the head of Nonesuch Records, who has done this for several of his other favorite composers. There's a John Adams box set, there's a Steve Reich box set, his son, and he wanted to do one with me. And I resisted it for a while because I didn't really understand what he was up to.
Well, there's always a kind of discomfort when it's kind of your greatest hits.
Well, that's part of it. But the other thing
is, the Rolling Stones, yeah, that works. I'm not sure it works with Philip Glass.
I understand that it is working because people seem to like it. But what I was resisting was the Tombstone effect.
Retrospective, and I'm so young.
Wasn't that kind of, well, actually, I was thinking. I said, I'm not done yet. But he had a very good idea. He said, look, artists have retrospectives in museums. But composers don't get retrospectives, and the way we can do it is the way we do it, and it gives people a chance to look at a body of work in my case was about 40 years, and otherwise they wouldn't ever be able to do that. But so the box set is a way of providing a view of a lifetime of work, and it doesn't have to be complete, and it doesn't have a beginning, it doesn't have an end.
Well, there could be a second set. Well. In 2001, Alan Cousin wrote in the New York Times, "The truth is, Mr. Glass and his music are always everywhere and have been since the 1980s. Do you have that sense that your music is everywhere?
I'm starting to get that sense now, but it's not something that I was so aware of. I've tended to be the last person that knew about a lot of things. I was the last person to find out I was a famous composer.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, people must have said, oh, my God, Philip Glass, I'm so happy that you're here.
You have to remember,
come to my party.
I had a day job till I was 41. That was 30 years ago, but still, that's a long time to... And I was well-known when I was 30, but being well-known and making a living are not exactly the same thing. So let's say we always talk about being rich and famous as if they go together. Well, they don't go together.
So what turned it around? When were you able to start living off the proceeds of
the actual moment was the commission for Satyagraha, which was in 1980. I had day jobs because I wasn't making a living writing music, though I was, in fact, performing since I was with my ensemble since I was 30. But at one point, I realized that I could make more money staying home and writing music than having a job. And that's when it happened.
And you could write more music.
I could write more music. And the piece I remember was an actual commission from the Netherlands Opera for the Satyagraha with a handsome sum of $25,000. And I was grateful and delighted to get it.
So you wrote a whole opera for $25,000?
I was still working at the time. But at a certain point, I realized that I really shouldn't be working anymore. I didn't need to. But it was about that time. It was, say, 1980, 1981.
You've said that you've never really agreed with being called a minimalist composer and instead described yourself in the Washington Post as a universalist composer. Are you just joking?
Well, yes, I was just joking. But the most truthful answer, which has the virtue of really being truthful, is that I'm a theater composer. I would say 70 or 80% of what I've done is opera, film, dance, theater. And in fact, what's interesting about that is that, and that comes up a lot in this box set, by the way. Oh, there are excerpts from the symphonies too, and I've written a few symphonies and string quartets. But I would say most of the work, like the piece you opened with, Koyaanisqatsi, is a film.
And when did that come out?
That came out at the same time, around 1980, 81.
So when I got Koyaan, when I saw Koyaanisqatsi, I thought you were a very famous composer who made a hell of a lot of money. You were working a day job at the time.
And you know, people think they listen to you every day. They think you make a lot of money too.
Well, so they know I work in public radio.
Well, that's
maybe composers don't make a lot of money unless they write.
No, they can. They can eventually. And there's a wonderful story about Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky meeting years after they had both left Russia. And they were a little, evidently at their first meeting, they were a little, I would say, cool with each other. And the thing that broke the ice with them was they began talking about how their copyrights had been stolen by the Russian government and computing together how much money they had lost through that. And at the end of it, they had become good friends. And you know, people... Samuel Barber became very well known through one piece of music. And that happens very often with composers.
Well, I suspect that you hear music by some other people and think, gee, I should get a royalty for that because you've had a certain
amount of
influence.
Well, I don't look at it that way. I think of the community of composers and artists as supporting each other artistically and influentially either. I have a lot of friends that I've grown up with, whether it's John Gibson or Meredith Monk or Steve Reich or people. We shared culture together. I mean, to say who had an idea would be like saying that we live on desert islands without knowing what's going on around us.
And a number of those people, and you and some others, have been called minimalists. What word would you have used? I mean, you can't say they're all theater.
You mean we can't use maximalist?
You know what? Sure, okay,
you'll let us do that. No, you know, the person who made up that word, the really truthful person, was Tom Johnson, a composer, famous for an opera called The Four-Note Opera. What else do I have to say about it? And Tom was a writer for The Village Voice and quite a good writer.
But there was also the time of minimalist painting.
That's right. Exactly. And the word was borrowed in the same way that at a certain point certain composers were called impressionists. That was also borrowed from the painters, Debussy and Ravel. But I would say today you rarely hear Ravel or Debussy referred to as impressionist composers. Those words tend to have a limited life. But, you know, they come about because of, especially today, editors and so forth. I won't say commentators on music, because you might have to include yourself. But people, they need to have something, a way of discovering very quickly, something which really is not really susceptible to such a quick description.
Your work has also changed a lot over the years. In fact, the first piece in this retrospective is from 1969, Music in Contrary Motion. Maybe we should listen to a little bit of it.
That's pretty hardcore. Yeah, put that on.
Now that's said to have an unfolding structure.
It does, and for sure that's a minimalist work. But that's what Tom was referring to. And the people that we were most impressed with, people like Saul LeWitt, Don Judd, they were icons even at that time. Although they weren't that much older than us, they were barely a generation older than us. But they had the idea of a repetitive visual structure, which they had done for the same reason that it exists in Islamic work, repetitive structures, because they wanted to get rid of the image of and the narrative. So that was a kind of a strategy to do that.
But it was also a time when a lot of music was meditative and almost had an hypnotic side. John Coltrane, for example.
Oh, wonderful composer. Wonderful
and
composer.
And Indian music was really quite popular at the time.
Wasn't there a program, didn't you used to have a program on NYC, something called Music from Outer Space or Inner Space or something like that?
Maybe.
It was probably after you went to bed, not before your time, but before you were. And it would be something like... after John Schaefer's program, as a matter of fact. So that would have made it about midnight, perhaps. And that was a lot of that kind of music. It was very spacey, very what we call New Age music, the kind of music records that you would find in a restaurant or a store that sold organic honeybee stuff. So, you know, that kind of thing. And I don't mean to say that it's inconsequential music, but it does tend. There tends to be a lot of it. It's not that hard to generate it.
But it has certain things in common. There are certain approaches to scales,
of course,
harmony and rhythm.
And we're really talking about a contemporary language. Now, one of the things that, and I have a lot of admiration for people even who weren't called minimalists, but Harry Parch was one who might have been.
He was a microtonist.
Oh, well, there you go. You're better at this, much better than I am. There was a language that was emerging after the great decade of dodecaphonic serial music.
Well, how are those composers responding to what you're doing? The once very avant-garde serial composers.
Well, at the time, they were very angry at us because basically Boulez he had charted the course of new music, and he expected everyone to follow him. And here are a bunch of jackasses in New York and Amsterdam and even in London who were going in a different direction. He was not very happy.
Did you ever wonder how your music would be perceived in the future, or were you just doing what you had to do?
No, I don't think we ever as a group thought of it that way. Though I have to say that Steve, very early, he and John Adams also, they also predicted that this music would become repertoire music long before. And I was much more skeptical, and yet they turned out to be much more correct.
Was Einstein on the Beach your first full-length stage work?
Yes, but I wrote that when I was about, maybe 29 or 30. But, I'm sorry, 38 and 39. But in fact, I had begun writing theater music when I was 20. And I worked with a theater company called the Malibu Mines Company, which started mm-hmm. in Paris when I was 26. So I had a good 15 years behind me before I met Bob Wilson, and I was working with theater and dance at that time.
Well, let's listen to a little something from Einstein on the Beach.
Well, New York Performance Center is the answer to your problem. Contact us, Francis, and give us all, Francis.
In that work, Einstein doesn't sing. He is, we only hear him as a violinist, and obviously a much better violinist than Einstein actually was.
Probably. And that was Lucinda Childs, I believe, speaking behind, who did some of the performing and eventually choreographed the dances for Einstein.
And there's no singing in this opera.
Oh, yes, there is. There's
mostly
a chorus.
Talking, isn't
yeah,
there?
There's a chorus that sings quite a lot. They sing in the knee plays, and there's spoken word, as you've heard with Lucinda.
But that almost sounds like Indian singing to some degree, didn't it? I mean, the way Indian drummers talk with da 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 da.
Perhaps if you could put on the third knee play, you would hear a bunch of people singing numbers very fast. But there's also a full fledged aria called The Bed, where we actually had to audition people to sing it, because people who sing it in a chorus don't normally would be able to sing it in that way.
Why do you think that opera was one of your first breakthrough pieces in terms of popular appeal?
First of all, opera is a popular art form.
Opera a lot open and die almost immediately.
Well, you can say that about plays and you can say that about books, but opera has been the place where entertainment and art came together. Just think of Mozart. I think of the Magic Flute, filling houses while he was dying. So opera has always, you know, it was the pre-film, pre-movie popular art form of its time. And to some extent, that's still true. It combines a text, movement, image, and music. These are the elements of a mixed media. Opera is the mother of all mixed medias. So it's always been a popular art form. And successful operas have always, in the end, become popular.
Keith Potter wrote of the finale to Einstein on the Beach, Spaceship, that it's a good representation of Glass's genius, a musico-dramatic fusion of harmony played out in motion, made relative by its engagement with repetition.
Well, Keith, he writes rather well, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, do you
I mostly
could you agree. Have said it better?
I've known Keith for a long time, and he spent a number of years writing about me, and I've come to find that I found him to be a very accurate writer. And he says things in a way I wouldn't have said them, but I think that they communicate the ideas very well.
My guest is Philip Glass. There's a retrospective 10-disc set called Glass Box, just released by Nonesuch, and that's what we're talking about. You wrote film scores for films like Mishima and Koinis-Katsi, also for The Thin Blue Line, The Truman Show, Dracula, Fog of War.
Hey, what about The Hours?
The Hours, more recently. I was thinking about you when we had Paul Schrader on the other day talking about Mishima, has just been reissued new print.
It's about time. It's a film that had certain problems that when it first came out, as you know, because there were political issues that were voiced by some Japanese groups that didn't want the film to be shown the way
still
it was.
Still not shown in Japan.
No, probably never has been shown. In fact, after that film came out, I never told Paul this. There was a 5-year period when I could not work in Japan.
And because of your association with the film?
I don't know. I'm just saying that for 5 years I couldn't work in Japan. Suddenly, after 5 years, I began working. And I think I had a 5-year exile, and I think it was whether it was consciously or spoken, I couldn't work in the country for 5 years. And a very famous actor played the part of Mishima.
Ken Ogata.
Yeah.
Well, Errol Morris wrote that he wouldn't have been able to imagine the movies that the two of you worked on without your music. And Koinis-Katsi almost seems to, the visuals almost seem to be an illustration of the music.
One of the things I've been able to do with film music, or I've tried to do, is to make the music itself an articulation of the film, to articulate the structure and the... It's often we think of music as kind of being a decorative part of a film,
or something that underscores the action.
But for example, the story of The Hours is a very complicated story, and the music actually makes it more comprehensible. That was the idea. So I've encouraged that. This is not an idea. This is popular. Generally speaking, and I've had a number of nominations in Hollywood. I've never won an Oscar, and I think with my I'm kind of a kind of a rebel rouser on this. I've all really wanted to redefine or to recapture the importance of music, and which I think is terribly important. I was listening. If you listen to the Bernard Herrmann scores for
Hitchcock
or
but they constantly fought, and Hitchcock didn't even want the violins in Psycho. And Herman kind of forced
prevailed.
It on.
And prevailed.
And can you imagine it without that?
And even something like Close Encounters. I mean, so many films where we remember the music. How about Jaws? Often we remember when you hear the name of a film, you will remember the music. The first thing you'll think of is the music. So the fact that it's truly part of the authorship of a film, and yet it's relegated kind of far down the line.
But you've also, it's the suggestion also here is that there's a certain collaboration. And you've done,
I do.
Many composers don't collaborate until the piece is performed, but you've collaborated a lot over your career.
I have, and not only in film, but in other things as well. But it's not that film composers don't want to collaborate, it's just that the studio system brings the music in at the end. With Kundun, which I did with Martin Scorsese, he allowed me to work with the music while he was filming, as I did with Earl, and as I did with Gottfried, Earl Morris and Gottfried Reggio. With Mishima also, Paul and I were talking about music while he was filming. I was even in Japan for some of the filming, and that's another thing I've done, Leonard. I have made a point of visiting the set of a film and watching it being made. I've tried to get into the process as early as I could, which is not an industry practice, but which people will do if they're allowed to.
Now, the part of the inspiration in those is what's being filmed, but how do you go about composing a new piece of music that's just a pure piece of music. Do you already have an idea of how you want it to sound in your head?
I rarely have any ideas. So I wait to see what comes up. For example, Symphony No. 8, which is on this recording, I believe. I think it's on, somewhere in the package, which is a symphony that was just in a few years ago. I do what everyone does who does non-programmatic music, which is based on the language of music and not on these external issues like a text or image or movement. When you just are dealing with the language of music, that's when you're writing your orchestra pieces or your string quartets. That particular piece, I was putting together ideas I had. I've been struggling with the language of Indian music since the day I met Ravi Shankar in 1964, trying to come to terms with it, and it's been in my music in and out for a long time. And in that, in Symphony No. 8, I succeeded in writing a full-scale, almost a 17-minute orchestra piece based on the structure of Indian music, which Western orchestras can play. And that's another part of it. I had to find a language that was that we could perform and at the same time would reflect the idea. So
using the Western notation.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that's the hardest part,
but
isn't it?
I think the rhythmic part is the hardest part. Combining different rhythmic patterns together at the same time and fitting them. I had learned that working with Ravi Shankar for a long time, and I finally was able to translate it into a Western orchestra piece, and that was just 2 years ago. So there are issues of musical language. I'm now working on an opera about Kepler, the great astronomer. And in it, I'm finding I'm reinvestigating the idea of key relationships completely all over again. And this is something which I had began working with in music school in Juilliard, and with Nadia Boulanger in Paris, virtually tortured me with the problems of harmonic movement.
So you start off with a musical problem, and then the piece grows out of the work on the problem.
Generally speaking, when we say musical problem, we're talking about the language of music.
It sounds to me like you keep on issuing yourself more and more challenges.
I do. But I don't think of it as a problem in an abstract way. I think about the language of music as an evolving perception of musical relationships.
Now, one more question before you go, and we're going to go out with Symphony No. 3. In fact, maybe we can bring it up a little bit now. But my staff wants to know what jobs you worked at before you finally were able to support yourself in music.
I did so many. When I was a student in New York at Juilliard School, I loaded trucks at the Yale Trucking, which was on the West Side Highway.
You helped move art.
Then I became a furniture mover. My cousin Gene Heistin, who was a very well-known sculptor, we had a company called Chelsea Light Moving. I became a plumber. I became a taxi cab driver. I worked with Richard Serra. That was my most fun job.
He used to help put up his shows.
Yeah.
Now, of course, we have the 10-disc retrospective, Glass Box from Nonesuch. Thank you so much, Philip Glass, for being on our show again.
It's nice to see you again, Leonard.